Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report, Health News in the News, right after this message. If you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 41% of what you create and produce. Government gets the biggest share, 59%. That's about $20,000 for you and about $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of special? And if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24%, and the government will net 76%. That's about $24,000 for you and $76,000 for the government. That even sounds like it's more special yet, doesn't it? That means if we're working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more. That's 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. Remember, that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. And that's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 24% of it. Now, why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package? And let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we're paying so much and receiving so little. To order your free general law CD package, just call direct, 417-273-4967. Or go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, talking about health and health news, starting with aspartame, the controversy over aspartame found in all diet soft drinks, popular diet lemonade products, pudding. In fact, it's found in more than 5,000 food products on your grocery shelves. It continues to draw concern in light of recent media reports. Aspartame, distributed by G.D. Sirland Company, has been called on the carpet by the FDA in the past for making misleading and potentially dangerous claims about their products. Decades ago, Dr. John W. Olney informed G.W. Searle that aspartic acid causes holes in the brains of mice. Dr. Olney insisted Searle replicate studies in his office. They showed brain damage. Searle never gave those studies to the FDA, nor did Searle ever inform the FDA of the study until after aspartame's approval and it had been put on the market. None of the tests submitted by G.W. or G.D. Searle to the FDA contradicted these findings. We'll see that only 1970. Now comes a new movie, Sweet Misery, which chronicles the medical horrors of aspartame. Claims have been made that aspartame may produce an MS-like syndrome as well as Parkinson's syndromes, for example, shaking. Dr. Betty Martini, who has spent decades on this issue bringing up the case of Michael J. Fox and Parkinson's disease, according to Dr. Martini, Fox is a former Diet Pepsi spokesman and reportedly is addicted to that Diet Pepsi product. And indeed, how could Michael Fox develop Parkinson's disease at the age of 30, an old man's disease? But aspartame, which is sold under the trade names NutraSweet and Equal, can precipitate Parkinson's and, as a neurotoxic drug, even interacts with L-DOPA. Now, a recent press release promoting the release of this film states, quote, a current review of recent peer-reviewed scientific studies have disclosed a pathophysiological mechanism to explain this connection. And as far back as 1996, it was shown that the lesions produced in the myelin sheath of axons in case of multiple sclerosis were related to excitatory receptors on the primary cells involved, which were called oligodendroglia. Recent studies have now confirmed what was suspected back then. The loss of myelin sheath on the nerve fibers, characteristic of the disease, are due to the death of these oligodendroglial cells at the site of the lesions. They're called plaques. Further, these studies have shown that the death of these important cells is as a result of excessive exposure to the excitotoxins at the site of the lesions. Normally, most of these excitotoxins are secreted from microglial immune cells in the central nervous system. This not only destroys these myelin-producing cells, it also breaks down the blood-brain barrier, allowing the excitotoxins in the bloodstream to enter the site of the damage. Aspartame contains the excitotoxin aspartate as 40% of its molecular structure. Numerous studies have shown that consuming aspartame can significantly elevate the excitotoxin level in the blood. There is a common situation during which the excitotoxin exposure is even greater. When aspartate, as aspartame, is combined in the diet with monosodium glutamate, also known as MSG, blood levels are several fold higher than normal. With the blood-brain barrier damaged, as in MS, these excitotoxins can freely enter the site of injury, greatly magnifying the damage. So we see that dietary excitotoxins such as aspartame and MSG can greatly magnify the damage produced in multiple sclerosis. Likewise, excitotoxins have been shown to break down the brain-blood barrier as well. Of equal concern is observation that we know that about 10% of the population, that's based on autopsy studies of the elderly, have these MS lesions without ever developing the full-blown disease. A condition called benign MS, a diet high in excitotoxins such as aspartame, can convert this benign subclinical condition into full-blown clinical multiple sclerosis. The amount of excitotoxins consumed in the average American diet is considerable, as shown by several studies. In addition, the toxin methanol is also in the aspartame molecule. Methanol is an axon poison. Combined toxicity of the aspartate and the methanol adds up to considerable brain toxicity and can convert benign subclinical multiple sclerosis into full-blown MS. Now, once the MS becomes full-blown, further consumption of excitotoxins magnifies the toxicity, increasing disability, and finally death. Recent studies have also shown that even single exposures to these food-based excitotoxins can produce prolonged worsening and neurological lesions. In addition, it's been demonstrated that autoimmune reactions, as occurs with multiple sclerosis, greatly magnifies the toxicity of aspartate and glutamate, the excitotoxins. We also know that liquid forms of excitotoxins are significantly more toxic because of rapid absorption and higher blood levels. In the face of this connection between excitotoxicity and the pathophysiology of muscular dystrophy and multiple sclerosis, it would be ludicrous to allow further use of this excitotoxin-containing sweetener. Now, several highly credentialed doctors appear in this newly released movie. For example, Dr. Russell Blaylock, Dr. John Olney, and Dr. Ralph G. Walton, to name a few. Also in the film is Arthur Evangelisti, a former FDA investigator who exposes the medical horrors as a result of the use of aspartame in food and drinks. Those who have seen Sweet Misery used adjectives like incredible and encourage everyone to see the world's main exports and experts on aspartame expose and the rebuttal and propaganda put out by the pharmaceutical industry in an attempt to cover up this horrendous public health hazard. Others in the field of medicine who were directly involved with the making of this film maintain that anybody who sees this movie will now know the whole story. G.D. Searle has maintained since approval by the FDA that aspartame is a safe product and discounts claims to the contrary. So there's your aspartame story for the day. Leukemia risks for children living near gas stations have been connected. Children who live next to petrol stations are four times more likely to develop acute leukemia than other children in the same area, suggests new research. The small study carried out at four sites in France looked at 280 children with leukemia and a control group of 285 children, all of them younger than 15 years. The children's mothers were given a questionnaire relating to their lifestyle. The researchers found that children living next door to a petrol station or automotive garage had a quadrupled risk of leukemia, and the risk of developing acute non-lymphoblastic leukemia was seven times greater compared with children who lived in the same area, but not next to a gas station. And it was very surprising that living near a petrol station had such a high risk, says Jacqueline Claver from the National Institute of Health and Medical Research, who led the study. The longer the child had lived in the vicinity of the petrol station, the higher their relative risk was. Prenatal exposure also raised the relative risk. Now, next to a rubber factory, Clavel suspects benzene in petrol caused the rise in cancer risk, although she says further studies need to be done. The link between benzene and leukemia has been shown for workers in a rubber factory, but the benzene levels were very high in that instance. Exposure to benzene is much lower for children near a petrol station, so it was surprising, she told the New Scientist. Richard McNally from Cancer Research, UK's pediatric and familial cancer research group, says that while the findings are interesting, they should be treated with caution. The study examined a relatively small number of leukemia cases, and the fact that it was based on interviews leaves it open to influences such as inaccuracy in the recollections of the mother's interview, he says. Well, ta-ta. Hang on, we'll be back with more on the Health News Watch when we return right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. And The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, here's our next story, cancer from depleted uranium. A growing number of U.S. military personnel who are serving or who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan have become sick and or disabled from a variety of symptoms commonly known as Gulf War Syndrome. Depleted uranium, known as DU weapons, have been blamed for many of these symptoms. Gulf War veterans are coming down with these symptoms at twice the rate of veterans from previous conflicts, said Barbara Goodnow from the Department of Defense's Deployment Health Support Directorate. A recent discovery by American Free Press that nearly half the soldiers in one returned unit have malignant growths has provided the scientific community with critical evidence, so say the experts, to help understand exactly how this DU affects humans. Now, one of the first published researchers of Gulf War Syndrome was Dr. Andreas Korenia Poth, and he told AFP that 27% of the Gulf War veterans that he examined have suffered chronic health problems, more than five times the rate of Vietnam veterans and four times the rate of Korean War veterans. Poth said his son had recently returned from Iraq, where he had been part of the initial Gulf War II assault from Kuwait to Baghdad. Out of his unit of 20 men, eight now have malignant growths, Poth said. Poth is not an expert on DU, but has written extensively about how the fine desert sand blowing around Iraq and the Arabian Peninsula provides an ideal vehicle for toxins, increasing the range and the effect of atomic, biological, and chemical agents, such as depleted uranium, that attach themselves to the particles. Poth described how during the 1991 Gulf War, he and others had inhaled large quantities of sand and sand dust that could have been laden with ABC agents. The dust destroyed our immune systems, he said. Now, here's Falk's theory. A researcher named Marion Falk, a former nuclear chemical physicist at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, is investigating how depleted uranium affects the human body. Falk said that eight malignancies out of 20 in 16 months is spectacular and should be of serious concern. This high malignancy rate found in this unit appears to have been caused by battlefield exposure to depleted uranium weapons. According to Falk, when DU, consisting mainly of uranium-238, decays, it transforms into two short-lived and very hot isotopes of thorium and protactinium. Then it undergoes further decay to another uranium isotope, giving off high-energy radiation at each stage of the process. Scientist Lorian Moret said that we can expect to see multiple cancers in one person. These multiple unrelated cancers in the same individual have been reported in Yugoslavia and Iraq in families that had no history of any cancer. This is unknown in the previous studies of cancer, she said. It is indeed a new phenomenon. Goodnow questioned Poth's report that 8 of 20 recently returned soldiers from one unit had experienced malignant growths. Goodnow and Poth did agree, however, that Iraqi ABC agents had not played a role in the 2003 invasions. This is significant because three factors have generally been blamed for causing Gulf War Syndrome. Iraqi chemical and biological weapons, that's number one, or the cocktail of vaccinations given to the coalition soldiers, that's two, and third, depleted uranium. Now, the absence of any detectable Iraqi ABC agents during the 2003 invasion of Iraq narrows this potential factor for delayed illness or disability among veterans to pre-war vaccinations or depleted uranium. Now, while the number of disabled veterans from previous wars is decreasing by about 35,000 per year since the War on Terror began in 2001, the total number of disabled veterans has grown now to some 2.5 million, more than ever before. Brad Floor of the Department of Veterans Affairs reported that this 2.5 million is an all-time high. And when asked if there are more disabled vets now than after World War II, Floor said yes. Terry Jameson of the Department of Veterans Affairs told AFP that current statistics indicate that more than 500,000 veterans of the 14-year-old Gulf War I era are now receiving disability compensation. During the same period, some 7,035 soldiers are reported to have been wounded in Iraq. With 519,000 disabled Gulf War I era veterans currently receiving disability compensation, according to Jameson, the number of veterans disabled after the war is more than 73 times the number of wounded in and out of combat from the entire 14-year conflict with Iraq. Depleted uranium weapons. Last December, Dr. Asif Durakovi, a nuclear medicine expert who has conducted extensive research on depleted uranium, examined nine soldiers from the 442nd Military Police Company of New York and found that four of the men had absorbed or inhaled depleted uranium. Several of the men had traces of another isotope, U-236, which is only produced in a nuclear reactor. Now, these men were almost certainly exposed to radioactive weapons on the battlefield, Durakovi said, and due to the current proliferation of depleted uranium weaponry, the battlefields of the future will be unlike any battlefields in history. Durakovi, then chief of nuclear medicine for the Veterans Administration, said that after Gulf War I, in which he served, what we are going to see in the future will be greater than what we now see from the past. Since 1991, the U.S. military has used DU in munitions as penetrating rods, which destroy enemy tanks and their occupants, and as armor plating on U.S. tanks. So when depleted uranium penetrating rods strike a hard target, some of the radioactive and toxic uranium is vaporized into ultrafine particles that are easily inhaled or absorbed through the skin. According to a survey of 10,000 Gulf War I veterans conducted between 1991 and 1995 by Vic Sylvester and the Operation Desert Shield Desert Storm Association, 82% of those veterans reported having entered captured Iraqi vehicles. This would suggest that 123,000 soldiers have been directly exposed to depleted uranium, Durakovi told us. Now, since the effects of contamination by uranium cannot be directed or contained, uranium's chemical and radiological toxicity will create environments that are hostile not only to the health of enemy forces, but of our own forces as well, Durakovi said. Because of the chemical and radiological toxicity of depleted uranium, the small number of particles trapped in the lungs, kidneys, and bone greatly increase the risk of cancer and all other illnesses over time, said Durakovi, an expert of internal contamination of radioisotopes. And according to Durakovi, other symptoms associated with depleted uranium poisoning are emotional and mental deterioration, fatigue, loss of bowel and bladder control, and numerous forms of cancer. Such symptoms are increasingly showing up in Iraqis' children and among Gulf War I veterans and their offspring, he said. And although I personally served in Operation Desert Shield as unit commander, Durakovi said, my expertise of internal contamination was never used because we were never informed of the intended use of depleted uranium prior to, during, or even after the war. The numbers are overwhelming, but the potential horrors will only get worse. Robert C. Kohler of the Chicago-based Tribune Media Services wrote in his March 25th article on depleted uranium weapons called Silent Genocide. Depleted uranium dust does more than wreak havoc on the immune system of those who breathe it or touch it. The substance also alters one's genetic code, Kohler wrote. The Pentagon's response to such charges is denial, denial, and more denial. And the American media is its moral co-conspirator. I might point out that, as a sidelight, the first Gulf War veterans are producing increasing numbers of deformed babies. So we find more and more deformities, birth deformities, coming from these Gulf War veterans from the first Gulf War. another one of the side effects from this depleted uranium. Now, while we were very excited about the potential of Saddam Hussein using atomic, chemical, or biological weapons, it appears that we have inflicted more casualties upon our own troops by our own use of atomic weapons, depleted uranium, than have our enemies that we feared so much. I got a call the other day, an email, says, "Bravo, George, as usual, an impeccable presentation. That was to be all, to end all of the answers to the question about milk," referring to my series on milk. "I wasn't expecting such an elaborate analysis, but I guess the website that I referred you to gave you substantial ammunition to work with. So if it was possible to artificially transfer knowledge from one brain to another, and you could choose one person to receive it from, I would pick yours. What else can I say? Best regards, Bob." Well, thank you very much, Bob. Bob also asks, "Hey, I forgot to ask you, how can you be sure your own milk is safe? Aren't your cows eating the grass that the chemtrail fallout is landing on? Just food for thought." The answer, Bob, is charcoal. I feed my cows activated charcoal, the kind of charcoal you buy in 1-pound packages, and I feed it to my cows to detoxify the cows. Charcoal is the best detoxifier that we can get. So just tuck that away in your heart. I also take charcoal personally every day to detoxify myself. All right, stand by. We'll take another break and we'll be right back. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not comparable or compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. And these programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. And the income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires us to commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires that we sign contracts with these foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And then we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is, theft and covetousness, in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Now, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way of life in our Constitution at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice that better way of life. Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, the nation's large farms fear an agro-terrorism attack. Now, the teeming Swift & Company slaughterhouse on the edge of Greeley, Colorado, has the feel of a military base lately because security cars cruise the fenced compound and periodic drills are run to prepare for any attack. And at the Wayne Farms poultry plant in Decatur, Alabama, armed guards patrol the ground searching for any threat to the tens of thousands of chickens. In Porterville, California, dairy farmer Tom Bercellos recently installed video cameras in his milking barns to keep watch over his 1,200 cows. Nothing seems further from the front lines of terrorism than the vast American hinterlands, and yet since the September 11th attacks, they have been drawn into the amorphous battle. Now, the threat is called agroterrorism, the use of microbes and poisons to shake confidence in the U.S. food supply and devastate the $201 billion farm economy. Diseases such as swine fever or citrus greening can spread across the land silently. A single outbreak of foot-and-mouth disease could require the destruction of millions of cows and result in a worldwide ban on U.S. cattle exports for years. The animal becomes a weapon, said Peter Kalk, an agroterrorism expert at the RAND Corporation, the Santa Monica-based think tank. And unlike the most feared bioterrorism threats, such as smallpox or anthrax, the latter of which was used with chilling effect in the aftermath of September the 11th. Some virulent agricultural diseases are easily handled because they are harmless to humans. The microbes can be obtained from infected crops and animals worldwide. No known specific intelligence has linked terrorists to attempts to compromise the food supply, federal officials have said, but concerns were sparked after investigators discovered that the September 11th hijackers had explored the use of crop dusters. Last year, Senator Susan Collins, representative of Maine, chairwoman of the Governmental Affairs Committee, said that U.S. forces found hundreds of pages of U.S. agricultural documents in caves in Afghanistan once occupied by Al-Qaeda militants. The expertise needed to mount a serious attack is very small, said UC Davis microbiologist Mark Wheelis. The amount of material needed, you could hold it in a ballpoint pen. To meet that threat, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is building or modernizing 24 laboratories to quickly screen disease samples from around the country. It has created rapid response teams of plant and animal pathologists in each region to respond to outbreaks and is proposing to spend $381 million on biodefense in the year 2005. We're looking at what changes are needed, said Jeremy Stump. He's the USDA's domestic security director, whose office is dedicated to the agro-terrorism threat, and we need to harden those targets. And yet the efficiencies of the world's most productive farm system, vast tracts of single crop fields and factory farms that crowd thousands of animals in tightly packed pens, make agriculture impossible to secure. For agro-terrorists, the target blankets hundreds of thousands of square miles and is in every section of the country, from remote rural enclaves to the edges of large cities. The biggest problem may be combating farmers' widespread complacency, the tacit sense that the chances of being hit by an attack are remote and that their lands are too vast to protect anyway. Naturally, when there's never been or has never been a Noah-like flood, people don't want to prepare for it, said Roger Breeze, an agro-terrorism expert who recently retired from a top USDA post. The first alarms about mysteriously sick animals began to leak out in June of 2002. The first phase of an elaborate war game staged by Defense Department counterterrorism planners in prime farm states, including North Carolina, California, and Kansas. Agricultural inspectors identified the infection as foot and mouth disease. Participants looked on with alarm as the simulated virus raced across America, and within weeks, only portions of New England, Hawaii, and Alaska were unaffected. After 45 days, 20 million imaginary animals had been destroyed. Losses totaled in the tens of billions of dollars. The public panic was leading to calls for martial law. Efforts to police state borders and contain the simulated outbreak fell far short, even after the armed forces were called in. It was absolutely devastating and shocking to me that a handful of agricultural terrorists and terrorism incidents could lead to the devastation of our economy, said Representative Steve Israel, a Democrat from New York who helped direct the response. The events were part of a series of Defense Department exercises codenamed Silent Prairie and Crimson Sky, conducted to test the abilities of government, military, and agricultural officials to deal with a simulated agro-terrorism attack. In our scenario, we had people in different towns shooting each other, Israel said. We had state governors ordering that people crossing state lines might be shot on sight. And in the late stages of the exercise, they discovered they couldn't feed people in the affected areas because of the quarantines. A military strike against the attackers was ruled out because troops couldn't be moved from the quarantined areas. And there wasn't one aspect of life in the United States that was not touched, Israel said. I attended this skeptically. I left with a sense of real gravity. Now, there have been several natural outbreaks of animal disease that lend credence to the view of the threat's wide scope. In December in Washington State, a single case of mad cow disease shut down most U.S. beef exports for months. Some nations still refuse to import U.S. cattle. 3 million chickens were destroyed in 2002 as exotic Newcastle disease swept through Southern California. And in 2001, British cattle were diagnosed with foot and mouth disease, forcing officials to destroy 4 million cows and sheep. As many as 80,000 carcasses per day were buried or burned on pyres that cast a pall over the entire countryside. The epidemic cost $15 billion in disposal compensation, lost trade, and tourism. Now, the British response was necessarily ruthless, although the disease rarely affects people, and meat from infected animals is safe to eat. Exposed animals become pariahs rejected worldwide, so authorities managed serious infections by killing not just every sick animal, but any animal close enough to have even been exposed. In the United States, where the disease has not been seen in 75 years, every cow, every sheep, every pig within a 5-mile radius of an infection typically would be destroyed. Beyond the economic damage, the unfamiliarity of an agro-terrorism attack alone could sow fear in a country whose citizenry rarely think about the safety of their food supply. Killing all of these animals and burning or burying them is exactly what terrorists want everyone to see, said Breeze, the former USDA official. If a real foot-and-mouth attack occurs, it might start at a place like Swift's feedlot in Gilchrist, south of Greeley. It is A small city of cows, about 80,000 packed into pens. Gates block entrances. Cameras and guards keep watch. Yet, unlike Swift's fortress-like slaughterhouse, Gilchrist seems an easy target for an attacker, lofting a bag of infected feed over the fence from nearby County Road 31. Within a 10-mile radius are nearly 500,000 cattle, said Bob Rolston. He's the past president of the Colorado Livestock Association. And the primary concern of most farmers and ranchers is a natural outbreak. One catastrophic disease outbreak in 15 years of market development is down the drain, said Mark Gustafson. He's a senior vice president at Swift. But the September 11 attacks added a new layer of worry. More surveillance cameras have been installed in Swift's feedlots. At the slaughterhouse in Greeley, every employee is searched before entering the plant through a tunnel accessible only from a guardhouse, said Jim Hillary, a company spokesman. Other large businesses have taken similar precautions. This year, a Wayne Farms plant in Alabama began to distribute products in tamper-proof trucks that monitor temperature, record door openings, and transmit global positioning coordinates to security managers. The company's processing plants now use internet-linked cameras that are monitored from a central office. Without the prior bioterrorism episodes, the idea that things can get out of control, people wouldn't have been ready for the change, said Sharon Heitla, the chief immunologist at California's Animal Health and Food Safety Lab at UC Davis. But 9/11 has made it all very real. And as the outskirts of cities encroach on rural America, farms have become as much a target for crime as any urban business, said Robert Matthews. And since 2001 attacks, some farmers look around the world and say, it couldn't happen here, Matthews said. But farmers don't want visitors anymore, he added. That's in the back of their minds. Controlled access. Well, that's what the agricultural circumstance or situation looks like in America today. It's an armed camp being fortified. Well, I hope they're successful, don't you? We'll stand by. We'll take a break here, and we'll be back with a closer right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, we're talking about agro-terrorism. Terrorism, which would involve, let's say, the introduction of hoof and mouth disease into a feedlot in Greeley, Colorado. American agriculture, which used to be agriculture, is now called monoculture. We used to have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of little, small, independent cattle operations. Now we have a few huge, humongous, 80,000, 100,000, 200,000 cattle in a feedlot, or sows, 100,000 sows in a pork operation. So it's a whole lot easier for the terrorists to target one feedlot than it is hundreds of small cattle operations scattered all over the landscape. That's the dilemma that we find ourselves in here in America today, and that's the reason why agricultural specialists are looking at the potential of agri-terrorism. Now, the industry has turned to advanced technology for assurance, but just like the battle against bioterrorism, targeting people, each method would only limit rather than to deter an attack. Breeze and Wheelis advocate greater use of vaccines, but the approach is fraught with problems, high cost, and logistical complexity among them. Foot-mouth disease comes in more than a dozen strains, each of which requires a separate vaccine. Many nations cannot readily distinguish between infected and vaccinated animals and would reject either at their border. Cepheid and Idaho Technology Incorporated market suitcase-sized devices that they call the first line of defense against agroterrorism. Originally designed as mobile sensors to protect people against bioterrorism, the sensitive instruments sniff the air to determine the presence of a deadly microbe. Such devices helped map Southern California's Newcastle outbreak. Scientists are experimenting with portable units at poultry farms and dairies, but the scale of the problem overwhelms such solutions. Each device costs at least $30,000, and thousands of these devices would be needed by producers and processors. A complementary approach known as animal tracing ignores the germs. It can't stop an attack, but it does aim to contain the damage by monitoring cattle more closely than parents watch their own children. For example, beef cows are typically sold 3 or 4 times and then travel, on average, more than 1,000 miles in their 24 months of life, often with very little or no tracking. Well, in the recent mad cow case, 6 weeks of frenzied investigation located only 29 out of 81 cattle from the sick cow's original Canadian herd. At a Greeley, Colorado feedlot, a dozen cows owned by Denver-based Maverick Ranch Natural Meats mill aimlessly, and a gentle poke with a long-handled paddle gets them moving down a tunnel leading to a hydraulic squeeze chute. The machine seizes each startled animal as a worker holds a small optical scanner close to its eye. The device is made by the Optibrand Limited of Fort Collins, Colorado company. It captures an image of the retinal veins and arteries at the back of the eyeball. It's a unique and a lifelong biometric identifier. The worker then quickly scans the animal's ear tag, ID, and for good measure, he takes a picture of its face. The data is encrypted, time-stamped, and then logged with global positioning satellite coordinates to mark the animal's precise location. The process is repeated each time the animal is relocated, and it continues at some advanced slaughterhouses as the animal is cut into steaks and chops. I want to pause here for a moment. Can you imagine what we could do with animals with that kind of technology? You know, with global positioning satellites, we can identify these critters to within 3 feet of their location anywhere on planet Earth. Can you imagine what we could do if we could use a microchip and plant it in the hands and foreheads of everybody on planet Earth? We could identify everybody on planet Earth to within 3 feet of his actual location on the Earth, anywhere in the world. Now, wouldn't that just be special? Well, every 10 seconds, a new cow in slaughterhouse and vernacular proteins or enters Swift's Greeley plant. Blood-spattered workers carve through the swaying 1,200-pound carcasses, a steamy, acrid stench of death permeates everything. Just after cows are killed, a worker scans the eyes on each carcass to capture the retinal pattern. Time, GPS coordinates, and a company barcode are added and relayed to Swift's database. The disassembly line reduces a carcass to servings with such precision that a box of meat can be traced to the cow of origin. McDonald's, a major Swift customer, recently announced a plan to make 10% of its hamburgers traceable. Eventually, Swift wants traceability beginning before birth using DNA and forward to the plate. Each tracing program is just gaining traction among large U.S. food companies at this time. The technology, however, hardly registers with the multitude of ranches and feedlots that supply them. For 4 generations or more, Abby Nelson's family has raised cattle across the country. As owner of 5-star land and livestock, she raises pampered Angus breeding stock known for their docility, beauty, and tender meat. Until recently, Nelson's 150-head ranch in Wilton, near Sacramento, California, always seemed as placid as her cows. Like many farmers, she clung to the old refrain, "We're safe because we know our land and our neighbors." Even the cost of living has pushed tract housing, malls, and schools into the countryside. "Since 9/11, we're more wary," she said. "We're all just looking over our shoulder a little bit. We worry about contamination to water or feed supplements." And Nelson regards potential agroterrorism as a rude intrusion into a genial culture. She locks gates and pastures, and when she drives around the ranch, she watches for strangers. "We're the beginning of the food enforceability in the industry," she said, "and people rely on us to make good conditions for the reliability of our beef." But she has no plans to install DNA sensors, biometric tracking devices, or video cameras, costly and possibly disruptive approaches that she sees as an overreaction. "We're very trusting in our industry," she said. "We do a lot of things on a handshake and a word, and we'll probably be just the first ones to go down as a result of it." Well, there's the problem, ladies and gentlemen. It's monoculture, big agriculture. I've recommended to my students, and I practice it myself, that we should have thousands, indeed millions, of small independent farms. Not with thousands of heads of cattle, with big multinational corporations owning and operating them, but rather tens of thousands, maybe even millions of small independent operations with 20 or 30 head, which is what I've got. Now, if there's 1 million of us, and we have 30 head each, that's 30 million head of cattle, and you've got to attack 30 million places. But when you put 100,000 head on one big feedlot, you only have to attack 10 of them to get 1 million head infected. I say we're a lot safer with forcing our opponents to attack 100,000 farms than 10. Furthermore, when we practice monoculture, we have hundreds of thousands of acres all planted to one crop, such as corn, soybeans, or wheat. If we actually practiced agriculture in place of monoculture, which we did in this country 50 to 100 years ago, before the multinationals, before the big corporations came in and took over agriculture, and farmers didn't all plant corn, they didn't all plant wheat, they didn't all plant soybeans, they planted hundreds of crops and variations of crops. And they had more than just one crop. They weren't just monoculturalists. They were actually agriculturalists producing 10, 15, or 20 products on their farms and ranches. Today, a dairyman produces milk. A beef operation produces beef. A soybean grower produces soybeans. The concepts that one man could produce soybeans, corn, wheat, cattle, sheep, fruit, and operate a stand and sell it at retail is beyond the comprehension of most people. In fact, it's beyond the comprehension of multinational corporations. And the objective, boys and girls, is control of the food source and supply. And that's why the big multinational corporations, in conjunction with the government, even exist. They don't exist in the best interests of the people, and they don't exist in the best interest of agriculture. They exist in the best interest of corporate monopoly. And they want genetically modified foods, genetically modified seeds, cloned sheep and cattle, and technology to rule, with just a few people in control of all of the food, from the seed to the grocery store. And when they've accomplished that goal, they will have accomplished a feat never before in the history of the world, the total control of all of the people on the planet. If you look at the people who live in the cities, they're totally controlled by the food suppliers. Only those of us that are out here in the countryside are still independent of food control. When they shut off the trucks coming into the cities, when they control the food from the seed to the bread that you buy on the shelf, they not only control food, they control you. That's why I suggest that you think about that. If you want independence, you need to get out from under corporate food control. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in both the United States and around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. It says my time is up. We're going to have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, the same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.